Counsel. My name is Bradley Switzer. I'm the attorney for the appellant in this matter, Andrew Fisher. Andrew Fisher was the plaintiff in the trial court in this matter. Mr. Fisher is a property owner in the Log Hill Village Unit 1 subdivision located in Ouray, Colorado. And Mr. Fisher, by his legal action, seeks to enforce the protective covenants for the Log Hill Village Unit 1 subdivision and to enjoin placement of a 92-foot tall telecommunications tower, which Dallas Creek Water Company, referred to as Dallas Creek, seeks to place on property it owns at the south edge of the Log Hill Village subdivision.
Counsel, excuse me, I interrupt you, but could you pull that back just a little bit where it's difficult to see the bottom of your... There we go. There, that's... Thank you.
On the right side of this diagram, which was admitted at trial as Plaintiff's Exhibit 111, you can see the tower that Verizon Wireless has indeed constructed on property owned by Dallas Creek, and which Mr. Fisher seeks to enjoin as a violation of the protective covenants. When Mr. Fisher learned in late 2008, early 2009, that Dallas Creek had plans to enter into a lease with Verizon Wireless for this type of communications tower, he filed suit in Ouray County District Court, asked for a declaratory judgment, and asked for an injunction. In response to the suit, Dallas Creek asserted several affirmative equitable defenses: abandonment, waiver, latches, and estoppel. It is Dallas Creek's burden, therefore, to prove each element of those equitable defenses. The evidence in those, their evidence must be clear and unambiguous with regard to their defenses, including that the Verizon Tower does not have a different or greater impact than prior assumed violations of the covenants.
Counsel,
yes, Sean.
It seems to be a disagreement in the briefs as to that particular fact, not necessarily whether it is relevant, but you seem to view it as dispositive. That is, if the tower is different or greater, they cannot prevail. Your opponent, of course, says, well, that's just one factor. Could you explain why you think that particular fact is dispositive?
Yes. The different or greater impact rule was even acknowledged as the law of the case by the trial court in this matter as an element. And the trial court judge uses the word element, that if the proposed violation has a different or greater impact, then it cannot withstand, it cannot support the equitable defenses. So that's the law of the case. Section 8.3.
When the court did that at the preliminary injunction hearing, didn't the court say the court wasn't persuaded that there was a greater impact by this particular tower?
Correct.
And that's a factual finding, isn't it?
Yes, but a factual finding that was premised upon a lack of this evidence. This document, this diagram was not introduced at the preliminary injunction hearing. The court.
There was no testimony as to how high the tower would be or how wide it would be or the panel size.
So there was some testimony, but this diagram was not available and the court never conducted a site visit. So at the preliminary injunction hearing, the ruling was just that, preliminary, and the court established the law of the case. And that law of the case, the court was right on target, right on point, because Section 8.3 of the Restatement Third of Property, which I've discussed in my briefs, specifically lays out the different or greater impact rule when it's juxtaposed against those equitable defenses of estoppel, waiver, and latches. Those defenses cannot prevail, and that's an element, and I believe it goes to the element of justifiable reliance. If someone proposing to violate covenants with a different and more substantial structure seeks to rely on prior, less substantial violations, that's per se unreasonable reliance. So, the trial court found that although they pleaded abandonment as one of their equitable defenses, the court did not find there had been abandonment of the protective covenants. The court did find that there had been an implied waiver, latches, and estoppel. And at the end of trial, in his order, there was absolutely no finding by the trial court regarding the critical element of different or greater impact as enunciated by the judge at the end, earlier in the case, making it the law of the case, in my opinion, and ignoring Section 8.3 of the restatement, which embodies the different or greater impact rule.
Mr. Schweitzer, your opponent says that the prior finding from the preliminary injunction hearing, or the testimony from that hearing, was admitted during trial, and that it's inferable that the trial court simply adopted that prior finding that there was not different or greater impact. What's your response to that?
My response to that is that this court should conduct an independent review of the facts and the evidence, the undisputed facts, because there is no apparent discussion, apparent or otherwise, discussion by the trial court in its final order of the different or greater impact rule, which it had previously adopted. Very unusual. So Fisher is requesting that this court reverse the trial court, grant him a permanent injunction, and order that the tower be removed.
They're asking for us to find as a matter of law that this is a different or greater impact which defeats these defenses?
Yes.
And the reason is because you view all these facts as being undisputed?
Well, there's specifically one major fact that's undisputed, and a major material fact. There are several material undisputed facts, but one stands out and alone, which requires reversal. And that is the different, more substantial violation of the covenants that's represented by this tower compared to, on the left side of this diagram, the towers that presently or have existed for some time on the Dallas Creek property. You can see clearly that these are shorter, narrower, and of a less substantial nature than the Verizon Tower, which, as I said, is in place. So that undisputed fact was also testified to by James Kennedy, the chairman of the Architectural Control Committee for Log Hill Village. He said, and he prepared this exhibit, by the way, that his analysis, and this is to scale, that his analysis showed that the proposed tower was 667% larger, spatially larger, than any prior tower on the Dallas Creek property. And Andrew Fisher testified that from his property, looking to the magnificent views to the south of the San Juan Mountains in the area of Ridgeway and Telluride, this tower would constitute a monstrosity in his direct view of the mountains. So even if you assume that one or more of the existing towers, which seems to be an argument by Dallas Creek, violates the protective covenants, which Mr. Fisher doesn't necessarily concede, I repeat, the affirmative defenses, the equitable defenses of latches, waiver, and estoppel have not been proven by Dallas Creek Water Company because there's an essential element they have not shown. They have failed to prove the element that the Verizon Tower will not have a different or greater impact. That's the rule. I've cited 16 cases in my briefs that adopt that rule. Those cases allude to numerous other cases dating back to English Chancery Court decisions where injunctions were sought in the 19th century for violations of restrictive covenants. And the rule has been applied so consistently since that time, and by American courts, that it's recognized in the Restatement First of Property, also Section 560 of the Restatement First. Comment F discusses the different or greater or more substantial impact rule. And today, the more current version of the Restatement, the third, per servitudes, as discussed in my brief, Section 8.3, a comment F, clearly acknowledges that these equitable defenses cannot prevail.
Counsel, I want to understand exactly what you want us to do. You want us to take a look at this one exhibit and rule as a matter of law that the new tower is different and greater, or has a different and greater impact, and that by virtue of that fact alone, the defenses, the equitable defenses fail. That's what you want us to do. Is that right?
I think you can do that, yes. And I would urge the court to consider that approach, yes.
Whether a tower in this case is different and greater, I mean, that depends upon a lot of different facts. I mean, this is not a photograph, for example. We can't see the context. We can't see how these towers are grouped. We can't see what the grade is on which these towers are placed. And how can you ask us to make that kind of a determination? That sounds like a factual matter for the court.
Yes, you can determine that, Your Honor. The plan drawings showing elevations and the topography with elevations have been admitted into evidence. Plaintiff's Exhibit 110. Numerous pages of drawings contracted for by Verizon Wireless and prepared by a Rex Crook, an engineering firm here on the Front Range. Please look at those drawings. They'll show the juxtaposition of the towers. They're all within about 60 feet of each other. They show the elevations. It's very educational. There's a lot of information in this case, Your Honor. This case has a history that goes back to 1976, if you want to look that far back, when the original protective covenants were adopted. And there has been a long and winding road to the present dispute. But there are, to answer your question, there is testimony from witnesses, that sworn witnesses and sworn testimony, that this is a different and greater impact created.
It sounds to me like you want us to weigh the evidence, and that's not our role. Our role is to look at the factual findings of the trial court and determine if they're clearly erroneous. If there's any evidence to support them, we have to uphold them. We're not a second trial court, but it sounds like you want us to be a second trial court.
No, I want you to look at what I consider to be, and Mr. Fisher considers to be, undisputed facts.
Well, you gave an example of him testifying that it's a monstrosity. You're not really saying that that's an undisputed fact, that it's a monstrosity.
Oh, but I did state, Your Honor, that the most significant undisputed material fact, which you can apply the law to in a de novo type review, is that the Verizon Tower has a much wider, taller, and more massive structure than any prior tower on the Dallas Creek property.
What if it were 10 feet higher? If it were 2 feet higher? I mean, where is it just because it's higher? Is it just because it's bigger?
That's a good question, but that's not this case. This case, you have to determine, then maybe there is a dispute. But in this case, it's 30 feet higher. With the whip on top, it's 42 feet higher than the 50-foot tower. That's this case. And I'd like to conclude now and request that this court apply that rule of different or greater impact. Remand is unnecessary because, as I stated, the trial court did not apply the proper rule. It had the proper rule, but did not apply it, and that's the different or greater impact rule. This court can apply the rule because Exhibit 111 is undisputed. I'd like to reserve the remaining time I have for rebuttal and request that this court reverse the trial court, grant a preliminary injunction, and order removal of the Verizon Tower. Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Scott Miller. I'm here on behalf of the appellee, Dallas Creek Water Company. At council table is Laura Maker. My registration number is 26181. Ms. Maker's registration number is 41385. And, Your Honor, I'd like to just start by bringing back the issue in this case before the court is whether the evidence supports the trial court's factual findings of waiver, estoppel, and latches in a covenant enforcement case where the evidence showed a new cell tower, albeit taller, is built on a property with three existing towers of various heights and widths above the tree line, and the other towers are disputed as to those heights, where there's a 30-year history of multiple towers and antennas and non-enforcement on this exact same property, where there's a history of residents putting their own TV antennas out there and radio, ham radios out there for pretty much since the inception of the subdivision.
Council, what fact other than the non-enforcement for this 30-year period are you relying on? What fact other than that did the trial court rely on in determining that these defenses have been proved?
The trial court relied on, Your Honor, several numerous facts to support its holdings on all three of the equitable doctrines, which, by the way, are completely independent grounds. And so this court can uphold on any one of those grounds and affirm the decision on that basis. So starting with, I'd like to actually set aside for a second the appellee's different and greater impact argument and focus on the independent ground of estoppel that the trial court found here. There was abundant evidence as to the estoppel element itself. Okay.
Well, I'm going back to this 30-year history, and it seems to me that's what the court focused on. It seems to me that's what your briefs focused on finding in your client's favor on these defenses. I realize there are other elements, for instance, like you say, the reliance, but the reliance was based on the history of non-enforcement. So it goes back to the history of non-enforcement. What else is there?
Well, one key fact, Your Honor, is the statements that were made pretty much all throughout the decade of the 2000s, starting from 2001, where the community itself, the ACC, the HOA, many residents encouraged the placement of this exact tower on Track 6. And the reason they did that is because they wanted to cluster all of the adverse impact into one location. Now, that was a finding that made its way into the trial court's final order, and I think the court put some emphasis on that. And the reason that's a key fact is that it distinguishes this case from all of the 16 cases that Fisher argues sets out a new, different, and greater impact standard. This is a case where the impact that is occurring is in the exact same location within actually 100 feet. It's all these towers are all being lumped together in the exact same location on the exact same lot. If you read some of the Fisher cases, Hersonalos, for instance, is a recent case they cited for their proposition of different and greater impact. That case illustrates the distinction in almost all of those cases, which is that you have this relative comparison between a violation over here down the street, or maybe not even within the plaintiff's viewplane, and then you have a new violation that occurs right next door to the plaintiff. And so the cases, of course, apply an equitable principle there that the plaintiff should not be held to enforcing violations that they can't even see, yet now there's a new violation that affects their interests. That's fine. We don't actually argue with that. Here, Mr. Fisher says right up front that the existing towers, okay, the existing towers he shows in his arm stick out like a sore thumb from his lot. Okay, so he bought a lot, moved closer to these towers, and is now subject. He was subject to that impact way before Verizon came along, and now Verizon is really not doing anything more but just adding to that impact. And in our view, that's really just a continuation of the same impact that was already occurring.
So, Mr. Miller, let me ask you this. Does this mean that Verizon and Dallas Creek can put five or six more towers up here on this tract with impunity, essentially, because of these findings?
No, Your Honor, not necessarily. First of all, I think I'm not answering your question. The answer is yes in terms of the covenants. The answer is no in terms of can they just place towers out there. As you know, there's a extensive county review process that has to be...
Let's just stick with the covenants.
So sticking with the covenants, yes, our position is that this covenant, because of the 30 years of non-enforcement, a consistent pattern of not only ignoring this covenant on this particular tract, but also encouraging the placement of towers. This covenant has been waived as to this tract.
Period. It's a dead letter.
I'm sorry.
That the covenant's a dead letter.
Not that the covenant is abandoned throughout the subdivision. No, Your Honor. That the covenant does not have applicability. The Section 7 restriction against antenna heights does not have applicability to this lot because of the waiver.
Now, let me ask you this. If, let's assume for purposes of discussion that somebody's raising domestic cats on their property for profit, and that's a violation of the covenant, and nobody seeks to enforce that covenant against them because the cats are pretty quiet, but then they propose to add other cats like lions and tigers that roar and make all kinds of noise. Is it your position that the non-enforcement of that covenant against the domestic cats means that you can add lions and tigers to that property with impunity?
No, Your Honor, that's not our position. And I think the cases actually talk about that, and that is one of the distinguishing features in these cases, is that when the impact is what they call trivial or insignificant or insubstantial to the beneficiary's interest, then that does not preclude them from enforcing a violation that is of a much greater impact. Okay, but the cases talk about, I think it's a Tuzzi case that Mr. Schweitzer cites. It's a good example of the language that is used in those cases. Grossly exceeds. It was where a garage was 2,200 square feet, and the next biggest garage was 940 square feet, and that was far away, three blocks down the road, not in the view of the plaintiff, and then much smaller garages below that. So you have that kind of case, and you see that. I think the key point, though, of all of this is that those are purely factual determinations. The final determination here of waiver, estoppel, latches, is actually a factual determination. And so there is no bright line rule that Mr. Fisher is urging here today. The restatement itself is not a bright line rule. He pulls out one clause out of one paragraph, out of one comment, out of one section of the restatement, and he focuses on different and greater, and by the way, that clause says different and greater impact, with emphasis on the word impact. It doesn't say different or greater. Okay, so, and I think this goes to Judge Jones's question, that just because a tower is 1 foot taller or 10 feet taller, now if the standard was different or greater, period, and there was no word that qualified that in terms of impact, well then, sure, now you have a bright line rule that if a structure is just simply higher, therefore waiver is inapplicable. That's not the rule. That's not even the rule from the restatement. And furthermore, on the restatement, you have to look at the preceding sentence to his own new test. The preceding sentence says that this test essentially only applies when there has not been an impact, a negative impact, on the beneficiary's interest up until the new violation. And so we don't even get in the door here with this different and greater impact, because Fisher has already admitted these towers he can see from his lot. He has been subject to that impact, and it's negative. It's negative because he said that these towers stick out like a sore thumb already to him. Again, I'm just trying to illustrate that all of these things were taken into account by the trial court, and these were all factual findings that the trial court made in totality to come up with a decision that there was waiver in this case. And no, the trial court did not cherry pick one sentence out of the restatement, Section 3, and use that as Justice Jones mentioned, as the dispositive factor, okay? And that's right, because there's nothing in the case law that says somehow a different or greater impact becomes a dispositive overriding factor. Matter of fact, the restatement itself has five other factors in that very paragraph. Okay, the restatement that he pulls his clause from says that the primary consideration, it's not different or greater impact, it's fairness to the parties, okay? And one of the elements of fairness to the defendant is when there's been a history of non-enforcement. And so that's just one of the factors that has to be considered too.
Let me ask you, there's an allegation that one of the trial court's findings is clearly erroneous. And that's in paragraph 19 of the trial court's findings, a statement that the construction drawings were found not to be substantial at the preliminary injunction hearing based on the testimony of the county building official. Where in the record is there any testimony from a county building official that the construction drawing changes were not substantial?
That testimony is actually at the TRO hearing that was brought by Ward. This, as you know, this case is consolidated with the Ward plaintiff. And that's at Defendant's Exhibit 96. It's pages 55 through 61. Let me make sure I'm getting that right. But it is at the TRO hearing.
Whose testimony was it? Can you identify the person who testified about it?
His name was Paul Christensen, and he was a county building official. And he testified that the changes in the building permit applications were not significant. So that is in the record that you have in this court. By the way, Mr. Switzer, on behalf of Fisher, did cross-examine this witness on that exact issue. Okay, so he can't claim that there was any prejudice there. And as to that question, this goes to this issue of whether the Dallas Creek had to resubmit their changes to the ACC. This issue is not dispositive. It's not even relevant to the court's holding, because the court found on a wholly independent ground here that Verizon Wireless and Dallas Creek did not have to resubmit to the ACC because the ACC represented that we don't need to see any further changes unless it makes the tower higher. Okay, it's undisputed that Verizon Wireless and Dallas Creek did not make this tower any higher. Recall that the ACC approved a 80-foot, 6-inch tower with the 12-foot whip on top of here, which is, by the way, the testimony is that that's essentially an invisible antenna on top of that. So there were no changes from what the ACC approved.
Can I ask you then to tell me why the contract that was attached to that email that says that any changes have to be resubmitted to the ACC? Why is that not in direct conflict with the email that says we need to see it again if there's a height change?
I'll have to look back at that email if it says that there was any changes.
Well, the contract that was attached to it, I think, is the document I'm referring to, not the email itself. There was an attachment, and I think Mr. Kennedy referenced it in his testimony at trial, that we had an agreement with Dallas Creek that required them to resubmit the plans if there were any changes.
Okay. Well, again, I think what we're doing here is we're wading into some of the factual evidence that the trial court considered. One of the key factual pieces on all of that in terms of this ACC approval is that you have to remember the ACC approved a cell tower with a 12-foot boom on top of it, okay, and that people had called that a double-wide trailer that was sitting at the 80-foot level. That was taken off by Verizon. Now, they didn't require a resubmittal when Verizon Wireless and Dallas Creek did that voluntarily in response to concerns by the neighbors, okay? And so, again, you have some elements here of reliance and estoppel, and you have to look at the overall intent of the ACC approval and what they were requiring. And I see my time is up. Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel. And, counsel, you have some time left, about a minute.
My attorney registration number is 14325.
Thank you.
The actions of the Architectural Control Committee
whatever they may have been, are not binding on Mr. Fisher, first of all. The covenants at Article 2 provide that every property owner in the subdivision has an independent right to enforce the covenants, regardless. So regardless of what the ACC has done or any other entity, every property owner has an independent right to enforce the covenants.
So counsel, I want to explore that because it's important here. So you're saying that if I buy a property in that subdivision today, that it just doesn't matter what's gone on in the past. If somebody wants to do something that's in violation of covenant, I must win because nothing in the past is relevant. Seems to be what you're saying. Nothing that any other owner did, nothing that the ACC did, it's not chargeable to me, so how could I ever lose?
Well, there was a discussion of that on the issue of joinder, and in fact, each lot owner does have the right to enforce the covenants, and joinder was considered, of all the lot owners, was considered by Dallas Creek at one time in these proceedings. And so that was a genuine issue, but we got over that and went forward on the facts. And I want to say one thing about that county building official who did not testify at this matter, and defendant's trial exhibit 96 made reference to was not, I do not believe, was introduced at the trial of this matter. There was no county building official testified at this trial or at the preliminary injunction hearing. Mr. Miller is correct. He testified at the TRO hearing that's not part of the record in this matter. In the Ward case, where a TRO was sought by Mr. Ward relating to the issuance of a building permit by the county, no building official testified at the trial of this matter. That is clearly erroneous. In conclusion, we ask that you reverse the trial court. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. And thank both of you for your arguments. The matter will stand submitted, and an opinion will be issued in due course.